So it's all here. The story of our time with the Barkov.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkov. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkov. I'm Mark Updegrove. This conversation features journalist, playwright, musician, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright, whose latest novel, The End of October, offers an eerie prescience to the COVID-19 pandemic we face today. Larry Wright, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark.
You're getting some incredible press for The End of October. Congratulations. Talk about what led you to this project.
Well, it actually started a decade ago, Mark, as a projected screenplay. Ridley Scott had read the Cormac McCarthy novel, The Road, this post-apocalyptic novel where a father and son are wandering through the ruins of civilization. And so Ridley's question to me was, well, what happened? I mean, what force or event was so powerful that it could cause civilization to just break apart? And, I considered nuclear war, of course. But what really came to mind very quickly is, as a young reporter, I was living in Atlanta and I did several stories out of the Center for Disease Control. And I was so enchanted by the ingenuity and the courage of the people whose careers were involved in public health. You know, and listen, I would rather be in a war zone than in a hot zone of a disease like Ebola or something like that. But, these were like intellectual swashbucklers, and they really captured my imagination and respect. So I decided that the force that I would enlist in what was then the screenplay was a pandemic. Honestly, I hadn't figured out the whole story. And Ridley went off and made other movies, and years went by, but it is always in my mind that there was a real story there. And so I finally decided in 2017 that I would write it as a novel. But this time, instead of trying to make it so cinematic, I would do the research that I needed to do, which I hadn't really fully done the first time around, and really dive into it and understand how these events would naturally evolve. And then the story came out of that.
So this book imagines a pandemic called Congolese influenza that starts in Asia.
Right.
And spreads virulently through the United States. And you see all kinds of breakdowns as a consequence of this. This is remarkably prescient. So one of my favorite quotes is from Harry Truman, who said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know." And similarly, you write of your prescient work, "What may seem like prophecy is actually the fruit of research. As a writer, I've always been more surprised by reality than by imagination. So I try to see how science, history, and human experience come together." What did the process of writing this book look like? What was your creative impetus for the flu you developed, this whole scene that plays out in the novel?
Well, I wanted to educate myself. So, of course, I always start by reading everything I can that seems pertinent. And a lot of it was histories of pandemics. And 1918 was especially on my mind. In fact, the template for this particular disease that I invented runs the same course as the 1918 flu. I even made a calendar on my computer, and I set the year as 2020, just a coincidence that I didn't expect to have come true, where the disease happens and it comes in around February, and then it spreads around the world. I went to talk to scientists in at the National Institutes of Health. I went to Fort Detrick, which used to be the head for, you know, where biowarfare was done, but it's now a very important research center for public health. And I talked, you know, not scientists at major drug companies, some of whom are overseeing the vaccine production right now. I mean, many of my sources are on the front lines of COVID at this very moment. It's not just medicine, you know, I mean, or not just human medicine. For instance, there's a lot in there about animals and animal experimentation. And I spent a good deal of time talking to veterinary epidemiologists. There's a submarine involved. I went to Kings Bay, Georgia, where we keep these nuclear submarines, and I had the best time. They took me around on one of these gigantic submarines. I had no idea they were so big. They hold 24 nuclear missiles. Missiles that are armed with nuclear bombs. Each of them 40 feet tall, if you can imagine this all crammed into a submarine. And they were doing some kind of test when I was there. And one of the guys said, "Well, would you like to pull the trigger?" Well, this is a test, isn't it? I mean, I'm not going to blow up the world. And so I pushed the button, and we're all still here to talk about it.
About intrepid research.
Oh, I had I know this is a grim subject, and the novel is in many respects very bleak, but the experience I had in writing it was tremendous fun. I was so enlightened and by so many of the people that I met, and people love to talk about what they do. And, you know, when I was talking to these experts about what would happen if something like 1918 flu appeared in our society, how prepared would we be? You know, would we be any better off than our ancestors? And this was a question they had all been thinking about their entire careers. And finally, someone came along and asked the question. So they were very helpful.
What do you think the answer to that question is, as you've seen what's happened with COVID-19?
Well, you know, the idea of making a virus, a vaccine, you know, we have not progressed so far on that front. You know, we're still, you know, talking about a year or a year and a half to make a vaccine, which is way too long. And there's no certainty that we will make a vaccine that would be effective. They tried with SARS, and they had the unfortunate consequences in some cases of making the infection worse. So, you know, this is a, you know, there's a reason we need to do human trials. It's chancy. The other thing is, you know, we're still using quarantine, which is something that was invented in Italy in the 14th century because of the plague. You know, it's still one of the major tools in the toolbox, but there aren't very many tools. Our science is far more, you know, sophisticated than it has, you know, I mean, it's constantly getting into a new level, but we still have not been able to solve the problem of countering a brand new virus that we've never seen before.
It's funny because it seems like we get over a major disease by developing a vaccine, and then we think we're invulnerable. You've written, or actually you've said in a recent interview, after terrible devastation, the siege is lifted and people go back to something like their normal lives. But while we tend to remember wars, we tend to forget diseases and their ravages. Why do we have such a short collective memory as it relates to pandemic disease?
That's a really fascinating question. You know, the 1918 flu, you know, it killed, you know, I mean, the estimates are so loose. They say between 50 and 100 million people worldwide. American statistics are a lot better. 675,000 Americans killed by the Spanish flu in 1918. That is more than all the soldiers who died in all the wars America was involved in the 20th century, World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, more people died of that. And yet, the 1918 flu was essentially flushed out of the living memory. And it was true, too, of the Black Death. People didn't speak of it. And that killed, half the population of Europe. So part of it, I think, is that diseases come freighted with stigma and shame. And people don't like to talk about it. There's little heroism involved in getting sick and dying of a disease. It's a story of victimhood. One talks about battling a disease, but the truth is suffering is what you do. And in the early 19th century, or in the early 20th century, many of the diseases that were conquered in the 20th century by the great medical advances had not been at that point. So we were still seeing terrible ravages of cholera and dysentery and typhus and diphtheria. And, those diseases, polio, so many of them were addressed in the 20th century, a great march of medicine. And I think that bred a sense of hubris that mankind has conquered nature and we have little to fear. But the truth is that nature has a lot of cunning traps in store for us.
Has it surprised you that it's taken this long for a pandemic to spread throughout the world, given the inevitability of infectious diseases like this springing up?
Oh, well, I was constantly reminded how lucky we were. Just look back since 2003, we've had SARS, which killed, 10% of the people it infected, MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which killed 35% of the people it infected, H5N1, which killed nearly everybody it infected, Zika, Ebola. These were coming at us one after another. And, especially with SARS, it was a great triumph of public health to contain that very contagious disease within 100 days. If the pandemic we were experiencing now were SARS rather than COVID-19, we'd be in a lot more danger than we are right now.
Your book imagines a scenario where there's a shortage of medical equipment and PPE. The vice president is a former radio host who has been made point person on the government response to the pandemic and can't seem to satisfy a very impatient president. And one of your protagonists in the book laments the lack of presidential leadership. And she thinks, as you write, the president has been almost entirely absent in the debate about how to deal with a contagion, except to blame the opposing party for ignoring public health needs. Did you take a hypothetical disease and then extrapolate for current conditions, including our administration? How did you imagine this?
Well, let me say my fictional characters are singular individuals, and so and they may be inspired by real life, but since in my mind I set it in present time, I was looking at the dynamics, the political dynamics that we're experiencing. So, there is some reflection on that. Some of it, like having the vice president be the head of the task force, it was sort of a lucky guess based on how bureaucracy works at the White House level. A lot of the book is conjecture based on how I see the world actually working.
When it was reported that there was a virus spreading so virulently in Wuhan, China, did you imagine that it would amount to what we're seeing in America today and throughout the world?
Well, they announced it on New Year's Eve, if you remember. And, it was already probably 6 weeks they think in middle of November was the first case. So immediately what I thought of was SARS, which also arose in China. And I had anxiety about how far along it was, because when SARS came along, the Chinese tried to suppress the fact that it was fighting this big contagion. In fact, when health authorities went to visit China, there were reports that they put the SARS patients in ambulances and had them drive around town until the authorities left the hospitals. I'm not saying that they have done that in this case. This is a highly political issue, but it certainly put me on guard. And I thought this could be dangerous. And the other thing is, I had no doubt that it would get out of China because disease doesn't respect national borders. And people were, I mean, by that time, 5 million people had already left Wuhan. So the disease was seeded all over the world already, and just took a little while to manifest itself in like Seattle and places like that. But I was worried, and by the end of January, I was ordering masks and gloves, and suggesting to my wife that we stock up on canned goods. I planted some lettuce because I figured that that might be something hard to get, fresh greens, and so those kinds of things. Little precautions. I unfortunately paid no attention to my retirement account. Some profit, I had written all about it in the novel, but it didn't occur to me until things suddenly tanked.
Based on the research you've done for this project, what you know about pandemics in world history, what have we done right in the United States to combat this, and what have we done wrong?
Well, I think I underestimated in the novel the solidarity of people to stand together and resist a disease, a great personal loss to themselves. I mean, I've been inspired by the fact that, for the most part, Americans are sheltering in place. And, it's come at enormous personal sacrifice. All the jobs lost, it's just a very impoverishing event. And so people behave better in real life than they do in my novel. The governments behave pretty much as expected or worse. I had a jaundiced view of how we would handle it, but also other governments as well. And, with only a few exceptions, I think, our various societies have had a hard time coping with this stress. And, we weren't prepared, even though the experts all told us what was going to happen and how. They just didn't know when.
Why were we not prepared? Where did we fall down on this?
Well, in terms of the United States, we had a medical stockpile, which was compiled back in the Obama administration and before that in Bush's administration. And it had been depleted and not replenished. We had examples of face masks that had kind of rotted. When the new administration came in, there were these massive budget cuts, and many of them in public health. So, for instance, the Center for Disease Control had a team stationed in China, as well as like 50 countries. It was a surveillance team. So whatever you might complain, however you might complain about the WHO, we had our own people there. But the budget cuts caused the Center for Disease Control to have to cut off most of its international surveillance. And then in 2016, pandemic response team, which was a part of the National Security Council, was eliminated. The head of that was a man named Admiral Timothy Zimmer, who had handled the malaria outbreaks in Africa and is credited with saving 6 million lives. That team would have been in charge of our response to the COVID-19 infection, but it doesn't exist any longer.
What's your view of the World Health Organization and the role they're playing currently?
Well, you have to understand that the WHO is a supplicant. It has no authority. For instance, in this latest outbreak with COVID-19, It was 3 weeks before the Chinese would even allow the authorities into the country. WHO was begging to enter, but it did not have the authority to go in without permission. And, you know, it's getting a lot of blame for its courtly behavior around Chinese authorities. But what else are they to do if they want cooperation? The other thing is, as handicapped an agency and is chronically underfunded, as handicapped as it is, it's the only agency charged with global monitoring global health and trying to create a kind of unified response. We don't have an alternative. And so, yes, I think it's not the agency that it should be, but it's the only one that we have.
And as you looked at the CDC, what is your view of the CDC's leadership during this crisis?
Honestly, Mark, I'm heartbroken. I thought the CDC was one of the most distinguished agencies in our government. And when I was a young reporter and I was reporting stories out of the CDC in Atlanta, I was so impressed. Such great scientists. They were always on top of things. And, I envied them as a kind of intellectual adventurer, and they had such erudite knowledge. I just was totally spellbound by these people. And for most of its modern existence, the CDC was very well led. I can't say that now. And it's been heartbreaking to see it stumble so badly. And at the cost of the health and many lives of Americans, had they been able to produce a reliable test early on, we would have been able to test millions more people than we've been able to do. We'd have a sense of the scope of the infection. And we also should be developing an antibody test because that's the key to returning to work. And so far, that hasn't gone very well either. So I don't know whether to blame the leadership or the lack of funding, but something has gone wrong in the CDC and it's hurt America very badly.
Do you get a sense of whether that's administrative, whether there's been a societal shift, whether there's a de-emphasis on organizations like the CDC? What do you think is at the root of their diminished capabilities?
Well, it's not just the CDC that's suffered these kinds of budget cutbacks, and I think you have to look at it too in light of this sort of assault on scientific integrity. I find this very dismaying and offensive that the greatest minds, the greatest experts in public health are being dismissed. But it's not, the budget cuts and the paring down of health authorities is all of a piece of this despising science. And I think that that's cost us dearly in this infection.
Is that part of a larger trend of anti-intellectualism that seems to have swept the country?
Yeah, I think that, populism and anti-intellectualism are married. They go together. You don't have one without the other. This business of encouraging people to go out in the street without masks and pressed closely together in order to protest having to stay at home. Well, we've seen this historically. In San Francisco during the 1918 flu, there was an anti-mask society, and San Francisco suffered one of the worst outbreaks in the whole country. There were, in the Black Death, there were flagellants that would, march through the streets, and pray to God, and they were, attracting immense crowds, and it just spread the plague. I will say, I am desperate for the country to get back to work. The economic devastation is horrible. But how much more horrible will it be if suddenly people go back to work and then they have to go back into isolation? And that will happen if we go too quickly. Giving the medical authorities time to work out, especially therapeutics, which they're doing right now, will save thousands and thousands of lives. There are some very promising treatments that are being worked on right now. But if we had not shut down, if we had not tried to flatten the curve, we wouldn't have had time to slow it down at all.
Do you see a solution for the right balance between protecting our health collectively and protecting our economy?
Well, I've been advocating using convalescents, people who've had the disease and recovered. They're incredibly valuable to our society right now for two reasons. One is they've conquered the illness in themselves. They are carrying something very valuable, which is antibodies. And thousands of them right now have volunteered to donate blood. And you refine that, just extract the plasma and filter it, making sure that you have no other diseases inside that bloodstream, but only containing the antibodies to COVID-19, then you can inject that in people who are currently suffering. We have a chance for that to be successful. The only problem is that it doesn't last forever, and it's hard to scale it up. I mean, you have to bleed people in order to get the antibodies, and there are a lot of courageous volunteers. They can go once a week. They can give about a liter of blood, and that might be enough for two or three maximum people to receive some this plasma infusion.
I want to go back to your stunning prescience. Not only did you portend a sweeping pandemic with this novel the end of October, but 22 years ago in 1998, you wrote a screenplay for a movie called The Siege, starring Denzel Washington and Annette Bening, which foreshadowed terrorism from Islamic terrorists throughout the United States. It didn't do particularly well in 1998, but it sure did well after 9/11 in 2001. But I wonder, as you look to history as your guide, is there anything on the horizon that you think will inevitably impact us in the immediate future?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about what kind of country we're going to be when we get out of this. And, you know, there's an opportunity when you have a terrible tragedy, as we have now, for a kind of civilizational reset. And 9/11 was such an opportunity. You know, I remember so strongly, Mark, that sense, and I know many people felt that, oh, we're going to have to change. We're going to have to become the country that we say we are, the country our parents gave us. You know, America has to stand for something again. And instead, we invaded Iraq. And it ruined the opportunity and changed our society in profound ways. And to take another example, the Arab Spring. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and you know, it's a region that is desperate for change and reform and democracy. And the Arab Spring came along. And I thought, this is the chance that they've had. But what happened is most of those countries became even more tyrannical. So we're at that moment again. We're facing a new future. But whether it's going to be a future where we, for instance, set aside the partisanship and the needless rivalries with other countries that keep us constantly on the edge of conflict, whether we demand responsible government, whether we behave as a more compassionate society, we have the opportunity. Now we can see that this all needs to happen. But whether we will step up and actually enforce those changes, that's yet to be seen. But that's the challenge that this disease has given us, the opportunity to overcome.
So are there simple steps, Larry, that we could take as a society to emerge from this stronger and more united so that we don't squander an opportunity like the one that we had after the terrorist attacks of 9/11?
Yeah, I think that, you know, demanding more responsible government is high on the list. We're going to have to start funding our health agencies. There's no question that we need. What I worry about is this particular pandemic, I think it's devastating, but in some ways it's just a warning shot. You know, more devastating diseases will come, and we have to be prepared for them. Now we see how unprepared we are, but we've been given the chance to change. And so I think that if we can change, then we'll be ready when the big one comes. This is not the big one yet, but it will come, and we need to be ready for it.
Is there a lesson we should derive from the end of October that could apply to the situation in which we find ourselves today?
Well, the end of October is a warning, you know, about where things could go. It's you know, it's bleak, I admit. You know, people have remarked on that. But I feel anxious about where we're going. I'm not trying to make it seem other than what I fear. I think that there are fractures in our society that are very dangerous and needless at the same time. We can heal those fractures. But I think if we don't, we have really serious consequences ahead of us. And if there's one message that I want readers to take from this, is that it's in our hands. It's up to us to make those changes.
My thanks to Lawrence Wright, to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and of course to you for joining us. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.